Let's continue our study of Mark's Gospel. This morning we're going to get into a passage that is probably one of the better known of the Gospel passages. If you had to write down three or four miracles that you knew were described in the Scriptures, I'm guessing that a lot of you would put this one down. Anybody here ever heard of the feeding of the 5,000? Yeah, well known, is it not? What's interesting about this particular account is that this is the only miracle that is actually recorded in all four Gospels. Of all the miracles that Jesus does, this is the only one that gets attention in all four Gospels. So it is significant. And when we read this, and you know, some of us learned this in Sunday school or Bible camp once upon a time, or at a five-day club, whatever the case is, and we hear about the feeding of the 5,000, what is the first thought we have? Free food. What a glorious thing! Free food! Especially if you're a parent with a large family trying to keep a budget going. You're kind of dreaming of the feeding of the 5,000 happening at your house. And the basis of the account is that Jesus is able to take a simple little boy's lunch. And through the power that is his, because he is God, he is able to multiply what really amounts to about five little flat pita breads, maybe the size of your palm and flat, and a couple of little sardines, and feed multiple thousands of people with it. You see, as human beings, hunger drives us, so we look at that particular miracle and we say, wonderful, food. But let me say something to you this morning. Every time Jesus did a miracle, we have to kind of be careful that we don't see the miracle as an end in itself. It was significant that he fed that huge crowd that day. But every miracle that Jesus does is not just an end in itself. We tend to look at this story and we think, oh, isn't it great? Free food. But every miracle that Jesus does is actually a declaration of who he is and his glory. And so you want to look at the miracles not only as the incidents in and of themselves, but you want to say, what does this miracle tell me about Jesus? Remember, we're in John's gospel, and John begins this by saying, this is the gospel of Jesus. Did I say John's? I'm skipping ahead. We're in Mark's gospel. Thank you. I need correction every once in a while. We're in Mark's gospel. There it is. And Mark tells us that this is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Everything in this gospel declares who he is and what he has done and what God's plan is through Jesus. So when we see one of these miracles, and here is, like I say, is a significant miracle because it's contained in all four Gospels, what I want us to see is not just the specific supernatural occurrence, but I want us to see what is the declaration that this miracle is making. Because it really does declare who Jesus is. And this morning we're going to focus on three declarations from this passage. Let me set a little context. If you remember earlier on in chapter 6, Jesus has sent out his 12 apostles on basically their first field trip. They're going to get a little ministry experience by going out. He sends them out in pairs, and as he sends them out, he gives them his authority. And because they are now ministering in the authority of Jesus, and this is significant, that when Jesus was on the earth, because he is the Son of God, he has all the authority of God, but the ministry does not stop when Jesus goes back to heaven, which he did almost 2,000 years ago. Jesus makes sure that the ministry continues. And in this case, he has handpicked 12 apostles who are sort of the first ambassadors or representatives of him, and he gives them authority. And what do? They go out there and they teach, and they cast out demons, and they heal people, and it's amazing, and they come back, and they report to Jesus, and Jesus determines that they now need a time of rest. Not only a time of rest, but let me imply that they also need a time of reflection. What exactly all went on during that ministry period? And we're assuming that it's at least weeks long, maybe it was months long, that the 12 were out doing this ministry. And as they are finally getting a little bit of a break for some rest and reflection, you know what? The demands of ministry just kind of crowd right back in them, and the crowd gathers once again. And that kind of sets up the context for what we're going to look at this morning. Now, coming off the prairies, I used to enjoy doing a little fishing when I was young. And one of the things you did back there is you almost always caught something. Sometimes it was cold, but you always caught something going out of the lake. And if you did manage to catch something, one of the great traditions of the fishermen in that part of the world was to have a shore lunch, which means you would come back and hopefully the fish was still kind of flopping a little bit so you could fillet it, and the fillets would be flopping a little bit. That's fresh. And then you'd bring a big fry pan and you'd put a big clump of lard in there because we were all worried about our cholesterol. And of course, I never ate this, but others did. And you'd throw your fresh fish fillets into this thing, and you'd throw in some dough, and you'd make fresh bannock bread. And you had what we called a shore lunch. And when I look at this passage, I'm thinking shore lunch, so that's what I've called it this morning. This is the great shore lunch. What does it declare about Jesus? Well, here's the 3 points. Point number one is that Jesus himself is the effective agent in any ministry. Any ministry that actually is a ministry from God and has the effect that it's supposed to have has Jesus as the effective agent. Secondly, we want to look this morning that this great shore lunch is going to declare that Jesus is the promised shepherd for God's people. You go back through the Old Testament, and just over and over again, God has declared that he is going to send a shepherd for his people. Ezekiel 34 is all about shepherd. It's quite an interesting passage. When we were at Shepherd's Conference a couple weeks ago, one of the new trends in ministry among the younger pastors is to say that we need to do away with the whole concept of shepherding. Pastors are not shepherds anymore. They're CEOs or they're guides or they're whatever they are. But nobody of this generation understands shepherding anymore. Well, the problem with that is that God declares himself to be the shepherd. You know what? If he's chosen that as an illustration to understand him, let's go with it. Jesus here is the promised shepherd for God's people. Third point we want to look at this morning is that Jesus, like Moses of old, will lead his people into a covenant relationship with God, and it's going to be an eternally better covenant. Jesus, like Moses of old, will lead his people into a covenant relationship with God, and it's an eternally better covenant. Let me read the passage for you, and then we'll start spending some time going through it. So John, I'm stuck in John this morning. Mark chapter 6. Actually, I'm going to make reference to John. Maybe that's why I'm doing this. Mark chapter 6, beginning in verse 30. God's word says, "The apostles gathered together with Jesus, and they reported to him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, 'Come away by yourselves to a secluded place and rest a while.' For there were many people coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. And they went away in the boat to a secluded place by themselves. The people saw them going, and many recognized them, and they ran there together on foot from all the cities, and they got there ahead of them. When Jesus went ashore, he saw a large crowd, and he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it was already quite late, his disciples came to him and they said, 'This place is desolate, and it's already quite late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat.' But Jesus answered them, 'You give them something to eat.' And they said to him, 'Shall we go and spend 200 denarii on bread and give them something to eat?' And he said to them, 'How many loaves do you have? Go, look.' And when they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. And he commanded them all to sit down by groups on the green grass. And they sat down in groups of hundreds and of 50s. And he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up towards heaven, Jesus blessed the food and he broke the loaves, and he kept on giving them to the disciples to set before them. And he divided up the two fish among them all, and they all ate and were satisfied. And they picked up 12 full baskets of the broken pieces and also of the fish, and there were 5,000 men who ate the loaves. All right. This account of the feeding of the 5,000 really begins with a reunion and a report, because the apostles have returned from what we would assume must have been a fairly successful ministry. Now, Jesus had told them, you know what, if you go into a town and they don't receive you, then shake the dust off your feet and keep going. But obviously, they had come from some measure of success. And they had been preaching, and they had been casting out demons, and they had been the Lord had been performing healings through them. And the question I would ask you this morning is, how was this done? Now, we understand how Jesus could do these things. Why? Because of who Jesus is. When you are God, the ability to preach the truth without compromise, the ability to cast out demons, the ability to heal diseases, that is perfectly within the scope of what God does. He's powerful. But how could these 12 men go out and accomplish the same thing? Please note what the text says, verse 30. The apostles gathered together and they reported to him, that is Jesus, all that they had done and taught. Can you see a little problem with the wording here? Was it because these guys were so skilled and so smart and so spiritual that they were actually able to do these things in and of themselves? Now, I don't think that's what Mark really meant us to say, but it's easily misunderstood that way. And as we get a little farther into this passage, Mark is going to make an amazing statement. And he's going to talk about how even though Jesus was doing miracles, and even though these guys were involved in doing miracles through Jesus, and it's through Jesus' power that they can do these things, how quickly it is that they lose sight of the one who does these things through them, and how quickly it is that they miss the point. Next week, we're going to be in the boat again. I think it's interesting. It says Jesus made them get into the boat. It hasn't been so long since the last boat experience. And he's walking on the water, and there's a statement made afterwards, you know, when he's in there, and that they had gained no insight from the episode of the feeding of the 5,000, which makes me think that they hadn't gained a whole lot of insight from the field experience either. That's why I think it's kind of really key that Jesus says to them what? They need to come away by themselves to a secluded place and to rest. Resting is good. You know, if you're involved in ministry, it's a demanding thing, and there are points where you need to kind of slow down and have a little breather. But what's equally important about ministry is that when you do kind of step back, that you spend a little time reflecting on what exactly ministry is all about. Because if we think that ministry is all about our efforts and that we are doing things for Jesus, let me tell you that that's not going to work very well. Ministry is not about doing things for Jesus. Ministry is about doing things with Jesus. Because without Jesus' help and direction and power and focus, ministry really does not happen. Lots of activity can happen. Remember, we're kind of back to what Trevor mentioned about the Ephesian church in Revelation in those first couple chapters. What was happening in the Ephesian church? They had all kinds of activities. They had all kinds of programs. They had all kinds of great things. And yet, what does Jesus say? Hey, wait a second. Your connection with me in the scope of this whole ministry seems to be missing. Ministry simply becomes activity when Jesus is not in it and directing it and empowering it. And sadly, nowadays, I would say that there's a lot of so-called ministries that produce a great deal of green leaves, and they look pretty from the outside, but the answer the question really is, are they producing the fruit that Jesus wants them to produce? I've mentioned John a few times this morning. This is why I was in John 15 kind of looking at things. And I mean, John 15 is always the passage that kind of refocuses me and centers me. Here's where Jesus is at that Last Supper, before he is going to be betrayed and crucified within a number of hours. And he's talking to his disciples, and he's saying, I am the vine. You are the branches. He said, abide in me, and you will bear much fruit. John chapter 15, verse 5. But he says, apart from me, what can you do? Nothing. Nothing of real value. It looks like there's activity going on. You can talk a good talk, but there's a reality that if it is not being done with the power of Jesus, according to the will of Jesus, for the honor of Jesus, you know what? Ministry ceases to be ministry. It becomes activity. Now, what's significant is that Jesus tells this to his disciples just before he's crucified. We're still a year away from that at this point. But you're already starting to see the struggles that they have, because they think that they are doing ministry, and yet they are not focused upon Jesus. And that's what's going to happen a little bit later on in this feeding of the 5,000. In fact, when we get to verse 37, Jesus answers them, and he says something just radical. These guys recognize the obviousness of the problem of this huge, hungry crowd. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat. Now, we know that this was done from one of the other Gospels in a purpose of testing them. He wants to see what their response is going to be. Did they learn anything during that field experience that everything that they were able to do that was effective was through him? So the question is, when Jesus says, hey, you give them something to eat, what should their response have been? Help us, Lord. We can't do this. Instead, what is their response? Well, man, if we had $15,000, which is about what this 200 denarii amounts to nowadays, and we went out to McDonald's and bought Happy Meals, it wouldn't be enough to give everybody something. Where's their focus? Just a self-driven preoccupation. What are we going to do about it? Ministry never works without the effective agent, and Jesus himself is always the effective agent in every ministry. They went away in this boat to a secluded place. Now, we don't know if they touched shore. In fact, I'm thinking that they had a long, slow boat ride across the Sea of Galilee, and they had probably a bite to eat while they were doing it. And this was going to be a time of reflection, but as they're on this boat ride, remember, the Sea of Galilee isn't that big. It's maybe 8 kilometers wide at the top. So you can easily see kind of from one shore to the other. And as these guys are out in the boat trying to get away from the crowds, because it says, you know what, they didn't. So many people are coming and going, they didn't even have time to eat. What could you see from the boat? Well, they could be seen on the boat, because people in the towns around there, you know, Capernaum and Chorazim and Bethsaida were obviously seeing them. And when they saw and recognized who Jesus was, and not only do they know that Jesus can do amazing things, but now that they know these 12 guys can do amazing things, they're kind of celebrities in their own land now. The people from the town see them, they start running along the shore. And if you, the way that this story goes, by the numbers that we're going to be talking about at the end, you pretty much had to empty out all of the towns in that area. And they're all running along the shoreline, which means if you're in the boat, you're looking to the shore and you're going, hey, what's going on here? As town after town starts running. Plus, at this point in time, we have Passover pilgrims making their way around the top of the Sea of Galilee and heading down towards Jerusalem. They wouldn't go straight south because they'd have to go through Samaritan territory. It was better to go through Gentile territory on the other side. And so you've got the Passover pilgrims. The whole shoreline is just full of people moving. And here are the 12 in the boat trying to get a little R&R. That would be rest and reflection. So they're watching. Now, the people saw them going, verse 33. Many recognized them, and they ran there together on foot from all the cities. We're talking about running somewhere, you know, about 15 kilometers. if you're going from the farthest place, which would probably be Capernaum. Bethsaida is a little closer. Chorazin is a little closer than that. So it's a good long run. How fast can you run 15 kilometers? Now, it really depends on how old you were. Back in the day, I'm assuming that I could do 15 kilometers, 3 to 4 hours, which a lot of you would laugh at, go, that was back in the day? Well, you're sad. Yeah, that's true. Anyway, now this is kind of an 8 to 12 hour journey, but they're on this 15K run. And they're going to end up being a little southeast of Bethsaida in a rather uninhabited region. And Jesus is on the boat with his guys, and they, we're going right back in to a crowd. It says, verse 34, when Jesus went ashore, he saw a large crowd, and he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. Jesus' reaction is not quite the same as the reaction of his disciples. Remember the reaction of his disciples as soon as the miracle was done? Send them away. Send them away. We've had enough ministry for one day. Jesus' response is compassion. But why is it compassion? It's significant what's expressed in the next phrase. He felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Now, I'm going to take you back into the Old Testament here a little bit. Do you remember who the first great leader of Israel was? Abraham is the starting point. And then you've got a couple more boys in Isaac and Jacob. Jacob sort of has the sons that get the nation going. But who is the first real great leader of Israel? It's Moses. All right, and Moses leads the people for about 40 years. And when Moses is about to go off the scene, there needs to be a new leader for these people. And Moses approaches the Lord and says, who will lead? And the Lord responds to Moses' prayer. And Moses prays in Numbers chapter 27, may the Lord appoint a man over this community so that the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd. There's the exact phrase. Because God cared for his people. The people that he called and the people that he delivered from bondage and the people that he brought into covenant with him, he cared for. They were like sheep without a shepherd. As we go a little farther into the Old Testament, in fact, a great deal farther, we get to Ezekiel. Ezekiel ministers about the same time that Jerusalem is carried off into exile, about 586, 587. And they're about to go into exile. And the problem with going into exile is they kind of feel like they've been utterly abandoned by God, even though this has been the promise for hundreds of years. And God has a purpose in all of this. And so Ezekiel shares this prophecy with the exiles. And it says in Ezekiel 34:11, for this is what the sovereign Lord says, I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. Which is good for exiles to know that God has taken this upon himself. It's a promise. You go a little farther in that same chapter, verse 31. And God says, you are my sheep, the sheep of my pasture. You are my people. I am your God, declares the sovereign Lord. It's good to know that, isn't it? The whole picture of God being the shepherd of his sheep, that's what Jesus is doing. Why? Because Jesus is God. He's doing exactly what is in line with what God does. He looks at them and he has compassion because they're like a sheep without a shepherd. Now, let me talk about one particular psalm here this morning, and it's probably a psalm that you all know fairly well. It's one of the best known of the psalms. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Now that's just the first three verses. There's more, but I'm going to stop there. I want you to see in the feeding of the 5,000 a parallel with Psalm 23. Look at verse 42. They all ate and were satisfied. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Everything that they needed was provided. Go to verse 39. Now, I know we're reading this backwards, but we'll read the whole thing again. And he commanded them. He commanded them. He made them all to sit down by groups on the green grass. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. Now, there's a couple clues in that. Israel doesn't have all that much green grass, especially that side of the Sea of Galilee. You know we're in the springtime here. But it's no coincidence that this is what's happening. Let's go a little farther. It says in verse 34, when he saw them, and he had compassion. He began to teach them many things. Let's go on. It says, he restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Can you see a little parallelism going on here? When we look at the feeding of the 5,000, even though it's free lunch, and that's great, Jesus fulfills both David's description of a shepherd, God the shepherd, of Psalm 23, and Jesus fulfills the promises of Ezekiel 34 that God will look after his people. And now we go back to John again, John chapter 10, where Jesus states twice in just a few verses, I am. By the way, I am is the name of God, the good shepherd. I am the good shepherd. This is a declaration of deity, but this also, Jesus understands exactly what his role is with God's people, that he shall indeed look after them and lead them into the paths of righteousness. Now see, the Jews had a real problem. They really misunderstood the whole concept of Messiah. They were looking for a Messiah not to bring them out of bondage to sin, but to bring them out of bondage from the Romans. What they desperately needed was righteousness, and they had no righteousness. I mean, that's kind of what Jeremiah 31 says. What's the problem? They got a heart of stone. How alive are you with a heart of stone? Not so much. The new covenant brings a heart of flesh. It brings life. It brings the dry, dead bones of Ezekiel back to life. That's what Jesus does. And that late afternoon's events declared who Jesus was and is. Because Jesus is the promised shepherd for God's people. Let me go on with John chapter 10. Jesus makes the statement that my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give them eternal life, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. Isn't that a glorious statement of assurance? Jesus knows his sheep. You respond to him because you know him, and nobody can ever take you away from him. What a great statement this is. Jesus is the promised shepherd. That's what the feeding of the 5,000 declares. It's more than just free lunch. Verse 35 says, when it was already quite late, his disciples came to him and they said, this place is desolate. It's late. Send them away. Send them away. Now, in John's gospel, I said that this account is in all four gospels. John gives us a little bit more information. He says that when this feeding of the 5,000 took place, it was just before Passover. I made the comment before that there were a number of Passover pilgrims circling their way around the top of Galilee and heading down towards Jerusalem. They were joined by everybody running from the towns. So you got one big crowd, all right? In fact, the feeding of the 5,000 is a little bit of a misnomer. Verse 44 says that there were 5,000 men, and that's not the usual word anthropos, which would be mankind, which would include women and kids. This is the word masculine males, 5,000 males, and what Matthew tells us in his account is that's not counting the women and children that were there that day. So now take the feeding of the 5,000 and start to expand it to the feeding of the 15,000 or the 20,000. This miracle gets bigger by the moment. And now we need to make a comment about what is ridiculously taught in some Bible schools, that this was no miracle at all. Everybody was so wrapped up in Jesus' teaching that they forgot to eat. And they all had food with them. And by holding up the little boy's lunch, this was a signal. Oh yeah, we should eat. And so everybody dug out the food that they had with them and shared it. And there was no miracle whatsoever. It's kind of like the Red Sea, where they say, well, you know, the Israelites crossed on a sandbar. The Lord didn't actually separate the waters. So it wasn't really a miracle. I always find it interesting that a whole Egyptian army could drown in that same 3 inches of water on the sandbar. But, you know, you don't have to be consistent when you're telling lies. What have we got here? Passover is what John says. Now, to the Jews, is Passover a big holiday? Oh, it's huge. It's huge. It's really the beginnings of the Israelite nation as a nation, not just as a family of Jacob. And they were all their minds are focused towards Passover, because for the, you know, the week before Passover, they couldn't have any yeast in the house. All the Jews are thinking Exodus. What was Exodus about? Well, they were led into the wilderness, and God provided food, and God organized them into groups, and they received teaching from God, and they entered into a covenant. You see any more parallels here? What's happening? The disciples understand it, and twice we've been told in earlier verses that the place where they are is a wilderness. And they have followed Jesus into the wilderness. Kind of sounds Passover-y to me. And once they're there, who will feed them? How did Moses feed the people of the Exodus? Well, Moses didn't. Who fed the people of the Exodus? God did. And now when you think of that, you're talking about a group that numbered in the millions. How much food do you need to feed a group in the millions? We had a little taste of that wilderness where they were when we were in Israel. Man, you know, there's a few odd leaves on little broom trees, but there's just nothing to eat there. And that God could feed a nation for 40 years. You know, what did Moses use? Well, of course, he used his Visa card, and he went to the local restaurants, and he got what they needed. Of course, in those days, you know, this is long ago, it wasn't Visa. It used to be called Charge X. And what Moses had was a Charge Exodus card. Okay, I was going for a terrible joke there. So, yeah, wait for it. And here's the groan. Yeah, okay. No, Moses didn't do it at all. Moses saw, as the rest of Israel saw, God provide food. What's happening in this event? God is providing food. What about the organization into groups? I think it's kind of interesting that one of the first things they needed to do, when you've got a group of millions in a wilderness setting, how do you do this? And along comes Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, and gives him some good advice. What does he say? He says, organize them in groups of hundreds and fifties. What does Jesus do? He organizes them into groups of hundreds and fifties. See parallels running here? I just find it fascinating how many ways this thing works. And of course, what did the children of Israel do when they were in that time in the wilderness? Well, they received teaching from God. What does Jesus do? He begins to teach them many things. What had happened to Israel in that setting after a couple of months? They were finally brought into covenant. God had established the covenant with Abraham, but it's ratified with these people because they say, we will do everything the Lord commands. What would Jesus do in about a year from now? He would enter the people of God into a new covenant. Now, it's an infinitely better covenant. Enjoyed a sermon I heard at Shepherd's Conference. It was taken out of Hebrews chapter 12, which some of you may remember from about a year and a half ago. You know, you have not come to a mountain that cannot be touched, but you have come to the heavenly Jerusalem. And the preacher was talking about what worship was like for the children of Israel at Mount Sinai. And, you know, nowadays we always have such a me-centered focus that we ask each other, so what did you get out of worship today? By the way, that's an absurd question. Because worship is not for us. Worship is for God. We get a great benefit. It's incredible to be part of worship. But worship is never focused on us. It's always focused on God. And he said, if you had been part of that Exodus generation and the question had been asked, what did you get out of worship today at Mount Sinai with the thunder and the lightning and the earthquakes and the barriers that prevented you from getting close? The best answer you had was, I got out alive. Because people died at worship. But we have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, to the church with the firstborn enrolled in heaven, to myriads of angels. That's what we come to. Worship is so different. And here, Jesus is giving them an opportunity to worship. It's just such an amazing thing. And the covenant that Jesus brings his people into is so amazingly better. Hebrews chapter 12 goes, or Hebrews chapter 8 says, but now Jesus has obtained a more excellent ministry by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which is enacted on better promises. So you see some parallels here with the Passover. But this is the one who is coming to enact a new covenant. But to get them focused, he kind of goes through this whole thing. Jesus, like Moses of old, will lead his people into a covenant relationship with God. But it's an eternally better covenant. Amen? Isn't that a great thing? Last couple verses here, and there was 12 basketfuls left over. What was that? That was lunch for the next day for the 12 guys. This is the God who knows and plans perfectly. He knows the number of hairs on our head. He knows when the sparrow falls. And at the end of all of this, there's 12 bag lunches for the boys next day. Amazing. Jesus is indeed the good shepherd. He looks after his sheep, including his servants, his workers. In the last verse, 44, and there were 5,000 men who ate the loaves that have already told you that Matthew in chapter 14, verse 21 says, and this is aside from the women and the children. So this is the feeding of the 20,000, the 25,000. This thing is huge. But what is the source of the miracle? It's that it goes through the hands of Jesus. The little pita breads get torn up. How many ways can you tear apart two sardines and just keep filling baskets over and over again so that I shall not want? So I ask you this morning, is this just a food miracle? Yeah, it's a food miracle. Of course it is. Don't want to take anything away from that. But really, it's much more, because this is a declaration of who Jesus, the Son of God, the Messiah, the Son of Man, the Lord of Lords, the King of Kings, who he is. He is the effective agent in any ministry. Without him, you can do nothing. Not for the kingdom. This miracle declares that Jesus is the promised shepherd for God's people. Isn't it incredible to know that we have that kind of a shepherd looking after us? Wow. You know, I've known a few shepherds in my day. Back in the day here, you didn't even ever admit to knowing a shepherd. Kevin uses shepherd on his email account. Kevin, how much time do you spend out in the flock cuddling your sheep? Not much. Not much. That's because most shepherds don't do that. But the picture of Jesus as the good shepherd is that he cares to the point where his arms are wrapped around his sheep and they are safe and provided for. What a beautiful picture that is. And this miracle declares that Jesus is the one who could establish a new covenant, who would establish a new covenant for his people. And it's a most excellent and eternal covenant. And it's why we stand complete and assured in him.